Jonathan Coe is a novelist whose books impress the critics, win awards, but also appear regularly on the bestseller lists. He's best known for writing serious novels that are also very funny. He made his name with What a Carve-Up, a satire about the 1980s. Then came The Rotters Club, about life in the 1970s, and its sequel, The Closed Circle, which scrutinised the noughties of New Labour. Now comes his 11th novel, which is called Number 11, and this time he's turning his gaze on Britain today. Jonathan Coe, the number 11 is a reoccurring theme in this book. Tell us why.
Well, for a very simple reason, really. I didn't have a title for the book to start with. Sometimes you get almost to the end of the book without having one, but I didn't have one for this book, so I just wrote number 11 at the top of the page, and it stuck.
And, of course, number 11 is the home of the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Exactly, yes. So I wanted it to gesture towards the political concerns of the book, even though, as is always the case when I write about politics, the politicians of the day, David Cameron, Jeremy Corbyn, George Osborne, are not actually mentioned.
Nonetheless, you take aim at a wide range of targets: tax evasion, food banks, library closures, reality television, university tuition fees. The picture that you paint of Britain today is somewhat depressing. Are you very pessimistic?
I wouldn't say that I'm pessimistic, but like everybody in the country, I think there are things I think we're doing wrong. There are things which give rise to injustice. It's a fact, I think, an undeniable fact, that levels of inequality, of wealth disparity in this country are increasing all the time. When the economy threatened to crash in 2008, everybody thought that we would change our ways and, you know, we would no longer rely on debt to the same extent and so on. But in fact, it seems to have been business as usual since then. And, what I wanted to convey in this book was this sense of kind of slightly teetering on the edge of an economic precipice, which I think we all feel a little bit in our bones since 2008.
And why did you want to look at that and write a State of the Nation novel?
It's a very common novelistic impulse to want to capture not just the experience of individual characters, but some kind of snapshot of the country as a whole. You find it in the 19th century novelists in particular, and I love that tradition, and I want to work within it. You know, at the same time, like everything else, the State of the Nation novel is prone to certain clichés. Very often in particular, I think the State of the Nation novel is actually a State of London novel, and I didn't want this to be a London-centric book. It begins in Beverley, in Yorkshire, it moves down through Birmingham and the Cotswolds, and it finishes in London. But really, I wanted to write about the nation in a broader sense than that.
As well as the political background to the novel, in some ways the story is about two girls who we meet as children and then grow up through the course of the novel. And I was very struck in this novel by the fact that women take centre stage. Most of the novel is told through the eyes of women. Mm. Do you prefer writing through the eyes of women?
Yeah, I do. It's not usually a conscious decision, because I wanted there to be, as well as the kind of pessimism and the satirical anger running through the book, I wanted there to be a note of gentle optimism centering on the friendship between two young people. Quite early on, it felt natural to me that they would be women. That was a relief in a way, because I do find it easier to write, more enjoyable to write from the female point of view. I don't know how well I do it, but there's a slight sense of liberation when doing that, because like many writers, I write to escape myself, and when I'm writing from a male point of view, there usually comes a kind of clunking point of realization in the writing of a book that actually I'm writing about myself again, and that's just tedious really for me and the reader.
Would you just give us a little flavor of that by reading us an extract?
The paradox is this: I have to assume, for the sake of my sanity, that I'm going mad, because what's the alternative? The alternative is to believe that the thing I saw the other night was real, and if I allowed myself to believe that, surely the horror of it would also make me lose my mind. In other words, I'm trapped between two choices, two paths, both of which lead to insanity. But no, I must put an end to this rambling and attempt to set down the story of another visit to Beverley to stay with my grandparents in the summer of 2003. A visit I made, not with my brother this time, but with Alison, my dear friend Alison, who at last, after so many years' mysterious distance, I've found again, picking up the threads of our precious friendship. This is our story, really. The story of how we first became close before strange, not to say ridiculous, forces intervened and drove us apart. And it's also the story of But no, I mustn't say too much just yet. Let's go back to the very beginning.
You wrote What a Carve Up back in 1994, and you've written a lot of novels since then. Does it irk you in any way that that's still the novel you're best remembered for?
It has done in the past a little bit, because the most important novel to a writer is always the one that they've just written. I kind of turned my back on What a Carve Up and didn't think about it and its success. And now I'm just grateful, as who wouldn't be, that I published a book 21 years ago which people still talk about. I never dreamed that that would happen.